This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. It's just part of what we supply on the Radio Northwest Network, have for 21 years, and plan to do it for a long time from now. And you're invited to the conversation, the best conversation in talk journalism. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Before I get to schools and other public entities, and how much trust you have left in those public entities at this point, before I get to talking about Joe Biden and his persuasive efforts to sell you on the idea that America can tax its way to prosperity, let me start with today's Twitter poll. Should your landlord require vaccination from all of his tenants? Now, I haven't yet heard of an example of this in the Northwest, but when I see it happening elsewhere in America, it makes me think. Chances are this is the kind of idea that at least one nitwit is going to try in the Pacific Northwest. So let me give you the example. A Florida landlord is mandating COVID vaccines for anyone living in his apartments. And this guy, Santiago Alvarez, oversees 1,200 apartment units. He says any brand new tenant or anyone wanting to renew the lease on the apartment they're already living in is now required to show proof of vaccination, and any employees of his who refuse to get vaccinated will be fired. The Washington Post carried the story. You don't want to get vaccinated? You have to move, says Alvarez. It's a lack of consideration for your neighbor. It's a lack of consideration to your own families and to their children. Folks, the press, the pressure is increasing, and the president is bringing it about. The governors of Oregon and Washington have been pushing hard, although it seems Brad Little, the governor of Idaho, has been pushing back a bit, and I'm glad to see that. A lot of the labor unions are simply laying down and saying, okay, we'll do whatever it is that our political masters tell us to do. Some of them have stood up for their workers. Others, I've been asking the workers, what are you paying all those union dues for if your union isn't going to actually represent your point of view? Now, unions represent both people who've decided to get vaccinated and those who've decided not to. If they've decided not to, does the union owe them at least some representation? And if your landlord came to you and said, if you want to renew that lease in a month or two, you best go out and get the jab. And if you don't, start getting the packing boxes, you're going to be moving out. How would you respond to that? I would say your landlord, it's none of his business. Number one, to ask that you disclose private medical information. He doesn't have any cause to do that. I don't think he has any legal authority. I have a feeling a lot of landlords are going to end up in court. But we're also going to see if we can get a hold of some of our favorite landlords. I'm not a landlord. I was a long, long, long time, decades ago. But I'd like to talk to some landlords. Would you ever go to your tenants and say, it's my job to force you to get the vaccine. If you don't, pack up and move out. I don't want you here. And again, this guy sounds like he's doing it under the law. He's saying, existing tenants can stay until they want to renew. When they want to renew, show the proof of vaccination or you're moving out. New tenants, you're not even going to be considered. And I think it's especially weird to see this kind of requirement at a time where in the Pacific Northwest, in both Oregon and Washington, we've seen so many limitations, both done at the city level and the state level, about what landlords are even allowed to ask. Are you allowed to run somebody's credit and check that and disqualify somebody? In many cases, landlords are not. Are you allowed to run their criminal background? Landlords are not. Are you allowed to refuse somebody because they're a convicted criminal and you think that may not go over well with your own tenants? We're seeing cities and states that are saying, you aren't allowed to check any of that stuff. But now I have a feeling the powers that be in a place like Oregon or a place like Washington are going to say, go ahead. We want landlords to inquire into your private medical decisions and prove that you're vaccinated or you have to move out. By the way, I want to do something very important today. And yes, it's personal. Happy birthday to my wife, Tina. My wife, next year of 25 years, she is celebrating her Jubilee year this year, and it is her birthday. So happy birthday to Tina. Now, let me ask you another hard question. After you've already considered the question about when your landlord shows up and demands to see your vax card, what are you going to do? People in the Northwest, I think, ought to be taking a hard look at whether or not the hugely funded government-run schools in Washington State, the public schools run by the state government and officially under the control of local school boards, although we've seen the reality of that, they have been hugely disappointing. Washington State spends about $17,000 per student per year. You could pay for tuition at the UW or the U of O a lot cheaper than what they pay for the education of your kids in K through 12 public schools. But consider this: Oregon's second largest school district had only been open a few days, and now it's going back to remote. That's Reynolds School District transitioning to distance learning next week. I asked you the question way back in the spring of this year. Can you get a firm commitment from the public schools that your kids go to, the public schools in your neighborhood? Can you get a firm commitment that they absolutely will open up this fall? And I suggested to you, whatever they tell you in May and June and July and August, don't necessarily count on it. Consider this: as KPTV reported, after just a week of in-person learning, Reynolds School will be transitioning to distance learning next week. A small number of students and staff tested positive for COVID-19. They're not even saying that they're sick, because remember, the vast majority of COVID cases are either asymptomatic or have mild symptoms, and they've already decided to beat feet and go to remote learning anyway. Second issue to consider in terms of the failure of the public schools: teachers who have decided that their classrooms are their own personal political playground. Case in point, Gail Groby of the Newburgh School District. I will quote her. "I'll say this personally. I've spent 23 years in this district." This is a teacher speaking, an employee, allegedly a public servant. And here's the word she says: "I spent 23 years in this district, and you can't tell me what to do. I know my kids, I know what's best for them, and what to do to help them feel comfortable. I took down the American flag in my classroom because that is the most political symbol there is. When I see Trevor DeHart sitting in those board meetings with the giant American flag behind him, it is terrifying." This is an American public school teacher saying the American flag terrifies her. She says that symbol does not stand for freedom or justice or equality anymore. This is a classroom teacher who's got your kids in her political thrall. She says it stands for violence and menace and intolerance, and I will not fly that in my room. In another case, she called it terrifying. Now, I could ask you the question: do you think anybody with that point of view about the United States of America and about the symbol of this country? She doesn't have a beef with a particular politician. Anybody can do that. She's telling the kids the symbol that represents the United States of America stands for violence and menace and intolerance. Does that teacher have any business being in a public school classroom? Does that teacher have any business accepting a paycheck from the public payroll? I'd have to say no to both of those things. In any case, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Your calls are welcome too at 866-439-5277. And emails go to the top of the line and the top of the list. Coming up in a moment, I'll talk about the plans to leave you freezing to death in the dark, and it's happening right here on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Radio
that
Northwest Network.
That makes a lot
Network.
Of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, it turned chilly over the last few days here in the Pacific Northwest, and if you're like me, you enjoyed waking up to heat and lights and a hot shower. Enjoy it while you can, because politicians have plans to leave you in the cold and in the dark. Tomorrow, in Washington State, the Building Codes Council plans to ban all natural gas in new construction. The Greenies hate nat gas, and frankly, they hate anything that burns. Some Northwest cities have already proposed forcing you to remove all your existing natural gas, your stove, your furnace, and your water heater. They want you to go all electric. They also want to force you to drive an electric car. The only problem is the Northwest Power Planning Council already forecast the likelihood of blackouts in less than 2 years. One chance in three. We're simply short of juice. America enjoys huge reserves of cheap natural gas, but your government masters, yeah, the same folks who threatened your job if you didn't mask and jab, they plan to make you switch to the power that we're running out of. Greens want hydro dams torn out. They want the coal plant shut down. They condemn natural gas and they forbid nuclear. If you don't like their plan to have you freeze to death in the dark, I suggest you stock up on sweaters, batteries, and firewood, or make some very different choices in the next few elections. Our question of the day, and this one comes in from Steve. Lars, I'm beyond fed up with the criminal support system we have today. Just yesterday, in Salem, a local tree service, well known to employ criminals, was doing a job in West Salem. Two of their employees got into an argument, and one of them pulled a gun and shot the other one to death. He then goes on to suggest that perhaps this guy was in, he was actually in jail a week earlier. We're still checking with the Marion County Sheriff's Department on that. Investigators say that the guy by the name of Muniz was working for R&R Tree Service when another employee, Jonathan Gonzalez Salcido, shot him several times. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I'm going to give today's Daily Grill, and they've received it before, to the TriMet Transit Agency. I got this email from Dustin who said, Lars, I work for TriMet. I know how you feel about TriMet. I and many others who work there feel similarly. This is in regards to vaccines and how TriMet is now discriminating against the unvaccinated employees. They're giving extra days off to the fully vaccinated and not to the unvaccinated. This is pure discrimination against medical and religious exemption. If a person decides to not get it for either of those reasons, yet doesn't get the same treatment and full vaxxed, that's a concern. Besides constitutionally having medical freedom, just another crappy Oregon government-run dump. Signed, Dustin. Today's best email of the day, you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at rivercityusa.com/careers. Barb Ramsey writes in, Lars, my thoughts on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Nancy Pelosi, she hated President Donald Trump so much, she instigated not one, but two impeachments. She knowingly denied additional police and military to protect the Capitol on January 6th. And then she declared it an insurrection by President Trump. She initiated a phone call to General Mark Milley, calling President Trump unhinged and encouraging the general to act beyond his authority, which, according to Bob Woodward's book, he did exactly that. If there's a threat to our democracy, it has to be in the embodiment of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. End of story. Signed, Barb. Barb, thanks so very much. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Let's go first to Marie, who's calling in from Mount Lake Terrace. Hey, Marie, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
For the teacher who is taking the American flag out of her classroom,
yeah,
she, I'll help her pack so she can go to another country, and she just stabbed all of us veterans in the heart and killed us. We have a lot of freedoms here in America. We are losing them daily, but we have freedom here in America. I will help her pack move.
Marie, thank you very much. Do you mind if I ask what branch of the service you were in?
United States Army.
Thank you very much for your service in uniform, and I really appreciate the phone call. You take care now. And again, thank you for helping to do something for America, unlike that teacher who defames America. Let's go to Nick in Puyallup. Hey, Nick, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Well, my wife and I have already decided that if our schools go to distant learning, we're unenrolling them and going to homeschool. And I found that these mask mandates here in Washington, you can go to every school district, each classroom, and they're not following the same standards. So that tells me it's politically driven.
I think so, too. And by the way, can I tell you something that'll, this isn't from your neck of the woods, it's not near Puyallup, but one of the schools in Gladstone, Oregon, they are now suspending in-person classes. Now, have you heard the president and Governor Inslee and Governor Brown all characterize this as an epidemic of the unvaccinated?
That's exactly what they're doing.
Well, but let me tell you something.
That's them.
They're sending 175 kids home from the Gladstone School District. Do you know who exposed them to COVID, according to the district's representative? It was a vaccinated...
I'm going to take a wild stab. vaccinated teacher, because everybody I know, Lars, that has gotten this Delta variant has been vaccinated.
And isn't that a strange little pattern?
I want everybody to listen. These are not elected officials. These are elected representatives. We can take them out of office. School boards, everybody. We have to get involved, though. We've been sleeping too long, and it's time for America to come back.
Nick, I hope we have seen this happen. Connecticut actually had an entire school board. All the members that were up for reelection had people run against them and challenge them. Who were from a conservative point of view. They don't want CRT in the classroom, critical race theory. They don't want the sexual nonsense taught. And that it doesn't mean they don't want sex education, but all of this indoctrination about, you know, about transgender and about other things like that, they don't want that stuff pushed on their kids. They don't want necessarily vax mandates. But I'd point out the Gladstone School District has now sent 175 kids home because a vaccinated staff member exposed them to COVID. Ted, thanks very much. I'm sorry, Nick, thanks very much. Let's go to Ted. Hey, Ted, we're close to the break, so let's make it quick.
Hey, how's it going today?
Very well.
Yeah, my daughter's actually one of the students from the Gladstone School District that was put on her two-week hiatus. And I just kind of have to wonder, you know, 2 weeks here, what happens in about 3 weeks when another person tests positive? We're going to take another 2 weeks off?
I'll bet they will. You watch, Ted. This is why in the spring of this year I kept saying, get a commitment of some kind. Either the schools are going to open or they're not, because I had a feeling they would keep saying, keep the money flowing, parents, taxpayers, keep the money flowing. But will we make a commitment to actually opening the schools? Not so much. Coming up in a moment, should your landlord require vaccination of all his tenants? One Florida landlord is doing that. We'll talk to a Northwest landlord coming up in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I told you that story about a Florida landlord who controls 1,200 apartment units who has decreed, apparently on his own, because Florida seems to go the other direction, but he has said, all of my tenants will be vaccinated. If you are a current tenant when you come up for renewal of your lease, if you don't show me a vax card, pack your stuff, you're moving out. If he has a prospective tenant who comes in, he will demand to see their vaccination record. If he doesn't get it, apparently this Florida landlord says, I'm not going to rent them an apartment unit. So I thought I'd check in with one guy I know I can call and ask about uncomfortable questions like that. He's in the real estate business, and he is a supporter of the show, Nick Shivers. You find him at nickshivers.com. So, Nick, welcome back to the program. And what do you think of this landlord? And do you think this kind of idea is going to spread?
Well, it's definitely going to spread, but there is no precedent until now. Lars, the first thing that I would say, it's illegal in Florida. He can't do it. DeSantis put in a no vax mandate passports. At this point in time, he cannot do it because it's illegal by Florida law.
All right. So it's illegal. Now, how many states have that kind of protection? And in fact, how far can a landlord typically go in saying, I want to know these things about you? Because I was relating to my audience that in many places, landlords are being told you can't check criminal record, you can't check credit record, you can't, you know, there are lots of things you can't check. You can't even discriminate in most places based on source of income. And to translate that for people, it means if somebody comes to you and says, I have a good paying job and I make enough money to afford this apartment, and somebody else says, I'm on welfare and I make enough I get enough in my welfare check to afford it, the landlord isn't allowed to say, I'd rather rent it to somebody who earns the paycheck instead of somebody who gets it through welfare, can they?
You know, these issues are definitely not black and white. But here's the fact. Yes, you're absolutely right. There are so many things that landlords can't do. And I always wonder when someone does something like that, what is really behind the agenda? Because the fact is, he knows he's in Florida. He chose to own properties in Florida. And the Florida law is you can't do that. And So that is that's the question. When I mean, it's across the National Association of Realtors are talking about, local administration for real estate boards are talking about that. Now we're going to see what the precedent becomes, because it hasn't happened as of yet. And I do not see that happening. And so I always go back, what is Mr. Alvarez's agenda here? Because he's already getting sued by four tenants right now. So that's the question that I always like to ask.
Now, let me ask you this. Nick, you do most of your business in the Pacific Northwest, and we're glad for your support of the show. Is it legal to do in Oregon and Washington and Idaho?
At this point in time, there is no precedent that's saying it is legal, but that he could do that here in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. No, he could not.
So you're saying, because there's no precedent, there's nothing that prevents him, as Florida law prevents him, a landlord somewhere in Oregon, Washington, Idaho. If they put this requirement in, are they going to run up against discrimination codes the way a lot of employees are saying, I have a religious right not to take the vaccine? And employers have to recognize those religious exemptions. Would a landlord run up against that if the landlord said, all my new tenants and all my renewing existing tenants have to show me their vax card or they're out?
Yes, I do believe he would run into some issues here locally until our state decides that is something that they can ask for, or federally.
Doesn't it seem a little odd, though, that in states where, as I pointed out to you, there are all these new restrictions, and you know them better than I do. You say you can't check and see whether or not somebody is a convicted criminal. And I know there are people who say, well, give the criminal a chance, you know, once he's fulfilled his obligation or she's fulfilled her obligation to society by serving prison time or paying a sentence or being on probation or parole. But are you allowed as a landlord right now to say, my tenants are not going to be crazy about having a convicted killer or a convicted rapist or a convicted child molester living next to them? This is bad for business. I want to say no to a convicted criminal as a tenant. Can you do that now?
You can definitely do a background check. Can you say specifically that is the reason that they are not getting the rental? No. But again, Lars, what I think is going to happen, I think I am always on the side of freedom, okay? And the fact is, if you look at the four states that have the most COVID, that's New York, California, Florida, and Texas. And oh, do they have different philosophies on that. So again, until there is some precedent on the local level or on the federal level, Mr. Alvarez has a big, big hurdle that he is going to go against. And I don't see it being solved anytime soon in any state, no matter what the local government or the local city passes.
By the way, let's take it from the realm of law, and let's take it to whether or not it's good business, because you're a good business guy. At least my observation is you do very good business. Is it good business for a landlord to say, I'm going to insist that all of my tenants be vaccinated? Do you think that's good business?
In Florida, absolutely not.
How about here in the Northwest?
I would say in the Northwest, I would say there would be probably a majority of people would say, oh, okay, yeah, I think that's true. In Oregon, let's just say, in Washington.
It would be good because you'd be able to brag to all your tenants, everybody here has been vaccinated, even though we're hearing that a fairly sizable number of people who've been vaccinated still get sick with COVID, still can transmit it to other people. We just saw a school that sent home 175 kids because a vaccinated staff member exposed the kids to a case of COVID that the vaccinated staff member had. So, I mean, is a landlord really even, do you really even have anything if you say all my tenants are vaccinated? Because that's no guarantee they won't get it anyway.
Yes, I think if you thought, again, looking at science, you can pass. Basically what it says is the vaccines supposedly help you from all the bad symptoms. So when they make the point of, hey, all my people that are vaccinated are going to get sick because of the unvaccinated, that doesn't really jive with science. So that is a point that a lot of the people that are pro, and I'm not saying that I'm pro vaccination or not, but the fact is that point saying if you're not vaccinated, you're hurting all these people that are vaccinated, just doesn't hold to science.
And by the way, Nick, I'd point out that it's now almost 2 weeks ago. Oregon reports weekly numbers on how many people were in the hospital, how many people died. And they said 20% of the people who died had been vaccinated. And I said, hold on a second. They said if you get this vaccine, it's going to give you, you're going to, at best, even if you do catch it, you'll be less likely to catch it and you'll have milder symptoms. How does 20% of the dead were vaccinated sound like mild symptoms?
Yeah, this is a very, very perplexing disease, Lars. And it's, I don't think we're going to have a black and white answer anytime soon.
I couldn't agree with you more. Hey, Nick, thanks very much. I appreciate you coming on to talk about this. Just to recap, a guy in Florida who controls 1,200 apartment units as the landlord has decreed everybody who runs for me will be vaccinated. They will show proof of vaccination or I won't rent to them. If they're an existing tenant, when they seek to renew their lease, they will not get a new lease. They will pack their boxes and get out if they don't show me a vax card. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone calls. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Today's Twitter poll, should your landlord require vaccination from all tenants? I'd say no. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. We like to call this Conspiracy Theory Thursdays. You can notice an awful lot of things that might generate conspiracy theories seem to happen on Thursdays. We're glad to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk, provoking you perhaps with our Twitter poll question, should your landlord require vaccination from all of his tenants? One Florida landlord is doing that. Is it legal? I've had at least a few emails from people in the property management business saying, I don't think this is legal. It's going to run against fair housing laws and the rest of that, both at the state level and the federal level. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com on the web. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. To your calls now, let's start with Bob in Tacoma, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk about why these brilliant scientists who developed the vaccines didn't foresee the fact that the vaccine effectiveness would fade over the months.
Yep.
Now, what month did they start testing on the first guinea pigs?
I think it was at the beginning of the summer of last year because we saw they sped up the testing process.
They actually started in March. In Seattle here.
With March the final vaccine in March of 2020, when the disease had only arrived on our shores. See, I thought the Operation Warp Speed
fully. They actually did. So they had 8 to 9 months of testing before they went to the emergency use authorization. So my question is, why didn't they find out or figure out that these vaccines would fade like they have been? Why is it taking another 8 months to figure this out?
I think I can spitball an answer for you, Bob, if you're willing to take that version.
Okay.
So
I'll
you
take
test.
A spitball.
Well, I mean, look, it's or a wag, you know, a wild, wild guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Wild guess. Wild guess with the middle initial missing. If you give somebody a vaccine and you say we want to make sure that this either reduces your chance of getting a disease. Or reduces the symptoms, the only way to really test it, Bob, which I don't think is ethical, I mean, usually what they do is they give the vaccine to 1,000 people, they give a placebo to 1,000 people, and then they say, in those two populations, we should see a difference in the number of people who come down with the disease. Then you test them in a couple of months, and you say, okay, in the 1,000 that got the vaccine, 50 of them got sick. And in the group that got the placebo, 200 got sick. And you say it appears the vaccine reduced the likelihood. But what you can't do ethically is say, you know, we've vaccinated all these people. Now let's deliberately expose them to COVID, because then we'll know for sure whether or not the vaccine works. There's no way to do that. And I guess what you'd have. Oh, go ahead.
That's not what I'm saying. That's not what I'm asking them to have tested for. That would be an unfair test to some degree. I agree. But why didn't they know or publish the fact that the vaccine effectiveness would fade in 4 to 6 months?
How would you know whether it's faded? Now, Bob, I've seen some of the test results from people who've had the vaccine and then been tested later for the presence of antibodies. And on all of those tests, they warn, we're going to give you a number, I think it's 4.5, that shows that you appear to be, you know, fully immunized, that you're showing the presence of antibodies. But they also warn you, that number doesn't necessarily mean anything. In other words, if somebody shows up at 4.5 and somebody shows up at 2.25, it doesn't mean they have half as much protection. And they've warned that they don't really know how to gauge how much protection you've got or whether or not it's fading. So if somebody was vaccinated and they show... Go ahead.
That's because the antibody test is only just a slice of the immune system.
Right.
And so, they're just looking at a very small slice of the immune system. It's very complicated. And,
it is.
And to make grand assertions that it's doing X, Y, and Z is really beyond the pale of science.
See, you've reached the same conclusion I have, because when they say, if we give you this vaccine, you are less likely to get it. Okay, in theory, you are. But if you get it, you're more likely to have mild symptoms. Well, Bob, how do you even test that? Because we're told by the doctors that with both Alpha and even with Delta variants of COVID, if you get it, you're very likely to have either asymptomatic, no symptoms at all, or mild symptoms. So, Bob, if you'll afford me this comparison, have you ever heard of elephant repellent?
No, I have not.
I spray elephant repellent in the studio here at least once a week. And you know what? To this day, I've never seen an elephant turn up in the studio.
Oh, yeah. I've got orange pills that keep me from getting in car wrecks, too.
So if somebody says, if you take this medicine, you aren't likely to get it, but if you get it, you'll have mild symptoms. And if they ask you, I mean, if you wanted to act like a dummy and say to the doctor, if I don't take the vaccine at all and I get COVID, either Alpha or Delta variants, am I likely to show no symptoms in most cases and mild symptoms otherwise? And the doctor's going to say yes. So in other words, if you take the vaccine, you either won't have symptoms or you'll have mild symptoms. And if you don't take the vaccine, you're either going to have mild symptoms or no symptoms. You might wonder if they're injecting you with elephant repellent. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. This is kind of a strange subject, and we've talked about it before on this show. It has to do with love letters, except not the love letters you might be thinking of. Love letters between somebody who owns a house and the person who would like to try to buy the house from them. And you might wonder, well, why do they have to write a love letter? Well, as you know, it can be a very competitive environment out there. So on occasion, when somebody really, really likes a house and they really want that deal to be, you know, put together, they want to persuade the person selling the house that they would be the best person to buy the house. So they sit down and they write a letter. Sometimes it's a single individual. Sometimes it's a couple. They write a letter and say, we love your house. We'll take such good care of it. We'll stay true to its destiny as a house. I mean, whatever you want to say in that love letter. Now, it might amaze you, but even in a country which has God-given rights that include the First Amendment, the right to free speech, that any state might say you are forbidden to write that kind of communication. But the state of Oregon likes to be different than the rest of the United States of America. It is, in fact, the first state in the nation to ban the transmission of real estate love letters. They enacted House Bill 2550, which the governor signed is now law. And I thought we'd talk to Daniel Ortner about it, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Hey, Daniel, welcome back to the program. Is this constitutional? Is this constitutional? Is this going to stand up when it finally gets to court? No.
No, it's not.
Well, see, that kind of short answer, that could keep the legal bills way, way down, but I have a feeling it's a longer fight than no, it's not. What's going on here?
No, I agree.
What should we think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when a law violates free speech rights and it restricts free speech, the state has to offer a compelling or a sufficiently important justification for it, and has to explain why it absolutely needed to restrict speech. And Oregon just can't do that here. There's no evidence that the legislator pointed to show that these letters ever contribute to discrimination or do anything bad. They're relying on speculation. It's a solution in search of a problem. There's no evidence that they're actually solving some great problem. And so there is no justification for this restriction.
Well, and in fact, Daniel, I could see the argument made that in a competitive environment where we hear about people bidding, you know, a lot of money, tens of thousands of dollars above an asking price to be able to get a house when other people are bidding on it, you might argue that since we assume that everybody can sit down and put their thoughts on a piece of paper like everybody else, that it might actually level the playing field a little bit for the people who don't have as much money, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, really, what this does is it often gives individuals who want to actually live in a home a little bit of a leg up compared to developers who want to flip a house or turn it into an Airbnb. You can say, I'm going to use this property well. I'll make a good neighbor for your neighbors. I mean, the important thing here is houses are not like buying a pair of socks or a T-shirt. People care deeply about their house. They care about their neighborhood. They care about their neighbors. And so there's a lot of factors that people take into account when selling a house that they should be able to take into account. And Oregon is basically saying, no, all you got to do is take into account the dollars and cents. It's denying this deeper personal expressive aspect to buying and selling a home. And that's part of the problem here.
I mean, because I would make the argument if I was, I'm not a lawyer, thank God. I mean, the courts are thanking their blessings every single day that I'm not a lawyer. But I'd argue that if the argument we hear all the time, which is as a group, people of color in this country are not as well off financially as the majority population. You say, okay, if that's the case, we need to level that out. Well, what's the way to level it out? If you do it based on just saying, no, I got to sell my house based on dollars and cents, then you're arguing the people who should win are the majority population that's better healed than people of color. This actually could work against people of color, which is what it was supposed to work in favor of, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that shows the legislator is, you know, going purely off anecdote. There's no evidence. The Realtors Association, who actually supported the law, unfortunately, but they basically said there's no evidence. We know of no single case that has been brought a discrimination lawsuit based on the content of a love letter. So this is just purely speculation. And as you said, it's just as likely that these letters help minorities have a leg up, have a chance to compete in a very competitive environment. And so no real justification for what the Oregon legislator has done here.
All right. So we just, do we have to wait for the first aggrieved party to be able to actually put this in front of the courts? That's one of the things I know people find frustrating, because they'll call me and say, this law is clearly unconstitutional, so the court should just decide that. And I said, as I understand it, you have to actually get somebody who claims to be a victim of the unconstitutional nature of the law. Is that the case with something like this?
So you do need someone injured. This law doesn't go into effect until the enforcement of it. It doesn't go into effect until January 1st of next year, but a lawsuit could be brought before then. Someone can say, I know once this law goes into effect, it's going to harm me, and the courts will decide it even before it's ever enforced. You still need someone who's injured by it. But here, that could be an individual who knows they're going to use the letter, but it could also be a broker, a real estate agent, someone who transmits these letters because they have the right to advocate. I mean, they also have there's also their First Amendment rights at stake. They're the ones sending these letters and contributing, and they're also representing their clients. So an agent could be the one to sue, as well as an individual, buyer or seller who's unhappy about this and going to be harmed by it.
Why do you think the Real Estate Association went along with this stuff?
I think it's, it really is this like kind of woke ideology of we're going to avoid any possible appearance of discrimination, even when, as you I think you said really well, this could potentially harm minorities. But there's kind of this, we're going to run away from any slight appearance of any danger of discrimination whatsoever.
But at some point, they must have gone to their attorneys and said, can we legally restrict people's free speech? And I would think that, Lawyer 101 would say no, unless it's restricting somebody from shouting Allahu Akbar, I've got a gun or a bomb, that you're not allowed to restrict people's free speech. And why didn't their lawyers do their jobs, Daniel?
I mean, the Oregon legislature does not seem to care very much about the First Amendment or the Constitution when they pass laws. The mentality seems to be, we're going to pass a law and let the courts figure out if it's illegal or not. And that's, you know, backwards. Lawmakers should be have a duty to uphold the Constitution. They shouldn't be passing laws if they think it's unconstitutional. So I think lawmakers are really failing in their duty that they take an oath of office to, you know, to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And they're not doing that when they enact these blatantly unlawful laws.
Now, tell Nancy Pelosi she thinks you don't even have to know what's in the law until after you voted for it. Daniel, thanks for the work you do at the Pacific Legal Foundation. I recommend your organization to people who call me up and say, I think my property rights have been taken away. I said, reach out to PLF. They may go to bat for you if you've got a good case. Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you on always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lars. Really appreciate it.
You bet. I'm going to get to your phone calls, and we've got a naysayer on the line. You know how that works. On Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and any day of the week, naysayers go to the head of the line, and we'll talk about teachers promoting child pornography and religious exemption forms for the no jab, no job mandates out there. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I get the most interesting emails, especially on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Cody Mann writes in and says, Lars, does Lars honestly believe that a man with more than 40 years of uniform service to America, including multiple war zone deployments, is a communist stooge? Actually, I haven't suggested that General Milley is a communist stooge, although his actions play right into the hands of the Chinese communists. He says, seems like an awfully long con for Milley to play. Could it be that Milley was honestly concerned about being forced to act on a manifestly immoral or illegal order? Well, Cody, I invited Cody actually to call the show. He says he's a journalist or Paris student. Here's the problem. Milley is the general who, according to Bob Woodward's latest book, did two specific things. He said he was concerned that Donald Trump, in the last weeks he was in office, was going to launch a nuclear attack on China. So he did two things. First, he told the people at the Pentagon, you are not to take any actions on the president's orders, only if you check with me first. He was giving himself veto power over the commander-in-chief, which you'd think the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Pentagon would understand. He doesn't have that authority. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand the commander-in-chief of the United States is a civilian. His title is president. Once you're chosen as president, you're the commander-in-chief until and unless you're removed. Milley is exceeding his authority dramatically by saying the president doesn't call the shots, I call the shots. And then Milley did something worse. Three different times, he told Bob Woodward that he had called the Chinese Communist Army, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and told them, America may be attacking you. If America is going to attack you, I will try to stop the attack from happening. And if there is an attack that is planned, I will call you in advance and give you advance notice. Now, I understand we're not in a posture where you expect that the United States is going to launch an attack on China. But if we did, and a Pentagon general called the Chinese ahead of time saying, my country is about to attack your country, here is some forewarning, he is blowing so many different rules in the UCMJ and in federal law saying, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. It's illegal for somebody at the Pentagon to second guess, circumvent, and basically seize control of America's nuclear weapons. So when you say maybe he was honestly concerned about being forced to act on a manifestly immoral or illegal order, Donald Trump didn't give an order to attack China. What Milley did was he said, in his fevered imagination, General Milley, apparently believed Donald Trump might do it. And so to stop what the president might do, Milley acted illegally and unconstitutionally. Did that make him a communist stooge? In effect, it did, by calling the Chinese communists and saying, I'm going to tell you what my country is doing before they do it to your advantage and to the disadvantage of the United States. If anybody thinks that's legal or common sense, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call. Speaking of naysayer, Steve, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Thanks for taking my phone call. So I'm kind of joking on the naysayer thing, but the whole the whole thing with the power where the blackouts and brownouts are coming because they're going to push away from natural gas. These blackouts and brownouts actually help me. I'm a standby home generator salesman. Kate Brown and Jay Inslee are the number one generator salesman out there for me because I go into customers' homes, see what's going on, and they have general concerns about, hey, am I going to lose this during the summer when the AC, I need the AC or when I need my heat? It's like, yeah, this is a real possibility. It's horrible that people have to resort to something like this when we have they want to push us all to all electrical, and the cost that this is going to cost homeowners is going to be absolutely insane. We're also, the company I work for is also an HVAC contractor. I'm going to sum this up really quick for you.
Sure.
Customers who have gas furnaces, we can do a gas furnace change out for probably $3,000.
Gas to electric, right?
No, just gas. So if we do a gas furnace change out, just about $3,000. What people don't understand is a home that has a gas furnace in it, they can't support the electrical. The panel can't support going to a heat pump. So you take this $3,000 change out for a gas furnace to upgrade the gas furnace to a new one to pushing them into a heat pump, that is a $20,000 plus upgrade. And a family of four that's making $60,000 a year, that's a third of their income that they're now pushed into doing. And who's going to pay for that? Not the government.
No, not the government. And Steve, I mean, in some ways, I've been in the news business a long time, Steve. And you know, when something really big and bad is headed our direction, whether it's a storm, possibility of an earthquake, you know, a flood. I mean, years ago, there was a big earthen dam in eastern Oregon, and they were worried it was going to collapse. And if it did, it was going to wipe out a whole community. And people got very concerned. They said, if this is even a possibility, and Steve, you've heard me talk about this. This isn't Crazy Lars saying we might have blackouts. This is the Northwest Regional Power Planning Agency, which works on behalf of all the Northwest states. They make official predictions, and they say, based on the number of power plants we have and the amount of demand we have a 1 in 3 chance of blackouts. And I thought, boy, if you ever got odds like that in an Indian casino, they wouldn't be able to hold back the. If you said you can come down and play blackjack, you got a 1 in 3 chance of winning. You go, I got a 30% chance of winning. You'd be there all night. And yet here's this 1 in 3 chance of something so catastrophic that would affect everybody in the region, even the people who are, you know, say they heat their house with wood, but all their lights go out. You know, and I don't know of anybody who heats their water with wood. When I was a little kid, my parents lived in a cabin for a while, and we had wood water heat. It was interesting, believe me. But then again, I took baths in a big metal tub in the middle of the kitchen floor. It was an interesting childhood, but it's not something I want to go back to. And so when you say we got a 1 in 3 chance within 2 years of rotating blackouts, and I pointed out a couple of weeks ago, California actually said to people, either turn off all your major appliances tonight between 4 and 9 p.m., you know, turn everything, don't cook dinner, don't run the AC, don't run a load of wash, don't, you know, use hot water, because if we use too much power, we're going to have to start rotating blackouts. And California's
what happens,
had, what?
What happens when you're an elderly person and you can't handle that kind of heat in California, and that short little wave that we had early this year? Yeah, you die.
Steve, I used to see people dragging around the green oxygen tanks because they've had some kind of medical problem. And lately you see more of the people, you don't even see them as much because they have a little thing that generates oxygen and they have one at their home, you know, if they need to be on a cannula supplying them with oxygen. So if you say we're going to turn out the power for, say, 10 or 12 hours because the region is short, do all those people just say, oh, well, then I won't have any oxygen for 10 or 12 hours? I mean, because this isn't just theoretical. And for all the people who have all these other needs, I mean, real needs, not just that their food is all going to go bad in the fridge. It may go bad in the freezer, depending on how long it goes on. You won't be able to take a shower or a bath. You won't be able to cook dinner. And you'll be sitting there in the dark, maybe in January when it's 30 degrees outside. This is coming at us right now. And I'm amazed. Every single Republican candidate running for governor in Oregon right now has said they would reverse this, these crazy decisions. All of the Democrats, and I think I'd put Tina Kotek in there too, they plan to go ahead with it and let you freeze in the dark. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. By the way, I want to give you this one little, it doesn't really relate to my conversation with Bernie Giusto, our retired police chief and retired county sheriff. But Bernie, I thought I'd let people know, if you wondered, has the entire investigation by John Durham into whether or not there were shenanigans by the lawyers and by the Clinton campaign to try to create that hoax of Donald Trump being somehow allied with Russia. There's a lawyer who's about to get charged. It seems it's going to grand jury, and I think people are expecting that he is going to be charged by a federal grand jury for lying to the FBI about this. And it sounds as though things are starting to break up, that perhaps we're going to see some Michael Sussman. He's with a firm called Perkins Coie, which I think the headquarters of Perkins Coie is actually in Seattle, although Sussman worked out of a branch of the law firm out of Washington, D.C. And apparently there's fairly good proof that he lied under oath to the FBI to help create the false narrative about Donald Trump. Welcome back, Bernie, by the way.
Thanks, Lars, very much. What we can expect here, the interesting thing is that this investigation has continued after the Trump administration left and after a new attorney general was appointed. I was suspected at that time that somehow it wouldn't be set aside because of the politics involved in what the actual question here is before Department of Justice. And apparently the new attorney general sees fit to let that independent prosecutor who is well respected on both sides of the aisle continue on. And so you never know when what brick comes out of the dam, that the dam starts to collapse, and where the deals have actually been made. It'll be interesting to see where we go from there, that's for sure.
But I kind of saw a tying, that word just came, it kind of came out last night, and then I saw some additional stories about it today. And it's amazing what a central role this guy played in going to the FBI, telling them, I'm just here representing a guy who's in the cyber technology business, when in fact the billing records for Perkins Coie apparently show that he was working on behalf of the Clinton campaign. And Bernie, what happens to people who lie to any federal investigator?
Well, the end result is never any good, and that's usually the crime gets charged. In fact, the truth would have done them a lot better in terms of what DOJ really has to act on, what they could actually bring a conviction on. But when you lie outright, and they remember, if the FBI has the questions, they already have the answer in their hand.
Yeah.
That's where they got the question.
Well, except in the case of General Flynn, they actually brought charges against Flynn, and they wanted to send him to prison. General Flynn has now been cleared. But you remember Martha Stewart, you know, the famous homemaker, you know, or the famous decorator type.
Right.
She went to prison not for insider trading, but because when the federal agents came to her and asked her, did you tell anybody about these things? And she lied. So it wasn't actually the insider trading that got her in trouble. It was lying to federal investigators, which is a criminal act. It's not with the cops. But I guess it suggests to me, Bernie, something that does tie into what I'd planned to talk to you about or ask you about, is public trust in the police. Is this just based on nothing at this point, because we have more reasons to distrust police agencies than we do to trust them?
You know, Lars, that's a great question, because, you know, the FBI has for many years, for decades, has had that premier title that means that the best in the world, actually, not just the best in this country. And in the last 5 years, that's been eroded greatly. And you can see it in polls, public polls, about people's trust in the FBI. And in fact, the director of the FBI sitting in front of Congress this week trying to explain another one of these issues where a number of independent operators, in other words, the kind of clampdown that should be held by the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, and the director of the FBI, simply no longer matters, that people act either independently or in some kind of a coup. That does not condemn every FBI agent. That's not what I'm saying. But the real power always rests at the top. And when somebody can go outside of what you would have seen under J. Edgar Hoover, let me promise you, it wouldn't happen that way. There weren't good things necessarily even then. But at least there was an ironclad hand on the on the internal workings of the FBI daily and weekly. And now I'm not sure who we trust. On the local level, it's a different question. So we'll use that word police. Yes, they're part of law enforcement, but police typically associated with the people in your community that you either feel more or less safe by the way that you perceive their effectiveness in the community. So and the ability to trust them. And once that public trust is gone, and I mean gone in a very specific way, meaning that the people no longer believe the police have the ability to answer their call independently and work for them independently on their case independently, nobody cares about the numbers of how many crimes get cleared, how many people get convicted, and when their house gets broken into next. That's the only crime that matters.
Well,
the fact of the matter is, go ahead, Doris, sorry.
I was just going to say, Bernie, and here's the practical on the ground. I now know that average wait times when you call 911 have gone to, on hold, have gone to almost 5 minutes. So you have some kind of critical emergency where you need either cops or medical or both, lights and siren, and you wait 5 minutes on hold, and then average response time to actually get the officers or the help to the people has gone from 5 or 6 minutes to 11 minutes. So in other words, you have the kind of emergency where you'd call the cops and expect a lights and siren response. And averages are now saying you'll probably have someone there just under 20 minutes from now. That's going to kill people, isn't it?
Well, more than that, I think, as you know, the defund the police movement has only, it's not only eroded resources in terms of the number of dollars of police officers are on the street, but the willingness of police to respond because of what they fear for their careers. And when we get to that point, when the police are worried more about their career than they are about your safety, this country is headed in the wrong direction in many places. And I'll tell you, things like how many crimes get cleared don't really matter to anybody who has a crime committed against them or called the police for emergency help. Because I've been a resident of the state of Oregon for 70 years off and on, and the fact of the matter is I've never called for the police, even though I was one. But when I do call, when I know that we call every once, a person calls once in a career, and we can't respond effectively, it doesn't take long before they quit reporting crimes.
No, and that's what I'm worried about, because we've got police agencies right now. As I understand it, the state of Washington, the Washington State Patrol has a bunch of officers who've asked for, say, a religious exemption to the vaccine mandate. And apparently the agency is just refusing every single request. Now, I don't think that squares with federal law or state law. And I think in the end, it'll be overturned. But we're going to see a lot more cops go out the door. So we've got defund the police. It's diminishing the cops. We've got city and county agencies that are cutting the budget to diminish the cops. And now we've got a vaccine mandate laid down to diminish the cops. I mean, at some point, it's got to start killing people.
Well, in between all that, Lars, that the only relationship that really matters to people in their community is that black and white, blue and white, green and white, gold and white car they see daily, and associate that with a little bit of fear, but a lot more respect. And when neither one of those matter to the community, the bad guys because they fear nothing, and the good guys because they can't find any help in it, we're in a place of limbo. It takes a long time to get back. What worries me more than anything is the experience since leaving this profession, and that's not replaceable in 1 year or 2 years, 2 decades, and then we'll talk about building it back to where it is.
Yeah, I can't imagine right now, Bernie, some young man or woman, 18, 19, 20, who's thinking, maybe I'll go get a college degree, and then I'll go into law enforcement. And you say, at this point, would you, if you were paying attention to the news, would you say, if you were the mom and dad of that kid, you know, it doesn't look like a good profession to go into right now. Respect is going down. Public response is going down. Funding is going down. And steer the kids in another direction. And at that point, you get less professional people to represent you. Bernie Giusto is a retired county sheriff and retired police chief. We'll get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I know that some of you have been skeptical about this, but the John Durham investigation into who was behind the hoax that led to the FBI investigation of Donald Trump, allegations of Russian involvement with Donald Trump. This goes right back to a guy named Michael Sussman, who as of today has been indicted by a federal grand jury. And you need to know what he was indicted for. You see, Sussman went to the FBI. And Sussman said, look, I'm here representing somebody in the cybersecurity world, and I'm concerned because Donald Trump may be linked to Vladimir Putin through a place called Alpha Bank. Alpha Bank was a big bank in Russia, or is a big bank in Russia. It's a financial company. And he believed, he said, listen, there are computer ties between the Trump campaign and Alpha Bank, which is tied in with Vladimir Putin. Now, he told the FBI he was working on behalf of a cybersecurity client. Do you know who he was actually representing? This guy, Michael Sussman, at the firm Perkins Coie, headquartered in Seattle, Washington, was actually working for the Democrat Party and for Hillary Clinton. So, and how did they find that out? They looked at the billing records. And they said when Michael Sussman was meeting with the FBI in this meeting, lawyers love to say, I talked to this client on the phone for 15 minutes. So you bill that 15 minutes to one client. For the next 15 minutes, you talk to somebody else. When he was meeting with the FBI, he billed those meetings to the Democrat Party and Hillary Clinton. He lied to the FBI, which will guaranteed get you in trouble. It's actually, while it's not technically a crime in most circumstances to lie to the police, you lie to the FBI or any other federal investigatory agency, and if it is a substantial lie, meaning it has something to do with the real case. I mean, if they ask you what time it is and you say it's 10 minutes to 2 and it's actually 3:30, that's not going to get you sent to prison. Lying to the FBI about a matter of substance will get you sent to prison. And if you don't believe me, ask Martha Stewart or ask General Michael Flynn, who was alleged to have lied to the FBI when, in fact, he had never lied to the FBI. In any case, let's go to some naysayers. Let's start with Michael. Hey, Michael, naysayers always go first on this show. What do you and I disagree about today?
Oh, hello, Lars. Sorry, I had said Mike, so I apologize for the confusion. So the reason I called in, I just have a disagreement with the energy grid and rolling blackouts in 2 years. The actual information being given, the reason I say that, when we did a NAFTA agreement with our neighbors to the north and the Columbia River Treaty with Canada, they had a very smart design in that they knew that we primarily were going after nuclear power. And I met actually a long time ago. I used to work for a bank. I actually met with one of the head
Michael, if you're going to tell us a long story without getting to what we disagree with, are we headed for rolling blackouts, as the Northwest Power Planning Council says, or not?
No. And the reason I say no is that with the treaty we have in place, they're able to purchase power from Canada at a reduced rate. And Canada basically turns up the hydro dams during the day, turns them down at night, and buys nuclear power back from us for pennies.
Nuclear power. But Michael, how much nuclear power do we have left? We have a little bit of the Whoops plant left, of one of the five Whoops plants. Where is the extra power going to come from?
Well, that was going to be my question for you, would be, are there any of the major politicians involved in this that own stock in Canadian energy? Because if
no,
there are,
I don't think this has anything. No, this, Mike, this isn't, unlike most things, it's not about money. It's about power. The people who run the states right. of Oregon and Washington, the Democrats, Jay Inslee and Kate Brown, they are global warming true believers. And what they have said is, we want 12 Western coal plants shut down, turned off. Now, they've already turned off Correct. Boardman decades before it would have needed to be turned off because it was too old. They've turned off Centralia Power. That's another one. They have 10 more plants that they plan to shut down in the next 4 or 5 years. When those plants are gone, that we're using the power from now, where is the replacement power going to come from?
Well, that would be my point. So I would argue that when Obama was in the administration, they passed these, I think it was called the Stock Act, that basically eliminated them from inside trading. And then immediately, as far
this
as I know...
This has nothing to do with stock. Michael, I want to bring you back to focus on the lights are on right now, and part of what keeps them on for this region is coal. It's 20% right. of our grid right now. When the 20% goes away, where will we get the electric power to replace it?
I think they would be investing in outside corporations out of the country, so they can benefit from it and well, buying power back.
Michael, where is the electricity coming from? If you say we're going to buy our power from China, we're going to buy our power from Japan, at that point, where are the lines going to bring it here?
I would say they're going to buy it from Canada using the existing treaty so they can make a small fortune off of building hydro dams in another country at maybe a lower tax rate. I don't know.
Okay, Michael, it sounds like you're just guessing, but that's interesting. Another naysayer. Will, what do you and I disagree about? And let's get into it faster than Mike and I did.
Yeah, so 99% of the people in hospitals right now are unvaccinated. Why do you keep downplaying the success of the COVID vaccine?
Because 10 days ago, 20% of the people who died in Oregon hospitals were vaccinated. Does that sound like success to you?
Well, compared to the rest of the states of the United States, it's 99%.
But we're not talking about who's in the hospital. We're talking about if 20% of the people who are vaccinated, or if 20% of the people who died in Oregon 2 weeks ago were vaccinated, does that sound like a success to you?
Well, that's 80%, and that's an anecdotal evidence since it's one.
No, it's not anecdotal. It's the numbers straight out of the Oregon Health Authority.
Which is comparative to the rest of the United States. It's one state out of 50.
I just want to hear you say that 20% deaths among the vaccinated is a success.
Compared to 80% in this case, yes.
Okay, fair enough. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on what we like to call Conspiracy Theory Thursday, named such years ago when we discovered that on Thursday, we seem to get a whole lot more conspiracy theories put forward by callers than we did any other day of the week. And today, it seems to fit very well. As I introduce Washington State Senator Chris Gildon, who represents the 25th Legislative District in Puyallup, Senator, I have to tell you something. The conspiracy, if somebody had told me a year and a half ago, the Democrats are going to conspire to eliminate or drastically diminish police agencies, release convicted criminals from prison, tie the hands of police so they can't arrest criminals, and then basically allow those criminals to do what criminals do to the general population, I'd say that's crazy. Nobody's ever going to sign off on that. But it sounds like your Democrat colleagues have done exactly that, haven't they, Senator?
Well, Lars, first of all, thanks for having me on the show again. And
sure.
I tell you what, you just said a lot. You know, what we've seen over the last year or so is just it's just been tremendous. You know, and today we're talking about prison reform, and we spoke previously about a lot of the law enforcement reform, how they're tying law enforcement's hands with the use of force bill and the tactics bill. They're reducing the penalty for crime with the Blake decision, which basically legalized drug possession. And then, you know, that's the first link is law enforcement. But the next link in the justice chain is with our prosecutors. And what we see there, Lars, is, as an example, 41% of all felony referrals in King County in 2019 were dismissed without action. 41% of all felony referrals they took no action on. Whenever you compare that to places like Spokane County, where they only dismissed 6%, you can really see one of the root causes of increased crime in our area. But, you know, today we're talking about prison reform. And certainly what we see is an agency that is absolutely out of balance. They've lost sight of their core mission, which we contend in the report, Prison Alarm Bells, which was released yesterday. We contend that the agency should designate public safety as their paramount duty. We fully understand that they have a really strong supporting effort, which is the rehabilitation of those under their care. And we absolutely want, you know, people who are in our prison system to get the necessary knowledge, skills, and abilities so that they succeed upon their release. But what we're seeing right now is those who that we are releasing early, we know that about 31% of them are going to reoffend because they're not in there long enough or they're not going through the proper programs to get those knowledge, skills, and abilities so that they can succeed.
Senator, one of the things I wish that politicians, including Republicans like you, would do is tell the Democrats we're no longer going to use their language. We're not going to say that when somebody is raped, that that's offending. Offending is when you break wind in public and don't apologize. Offending is when you chew with your mouth full, when you rape somebody, when you assault somebody. You know, when you start saying they're not inmates or convicts, they're adults in custody, which is one thing, that they've committed an offense, that we're going to reform prison. If we could get back to honest language and say we're going to cut convicted criminals loose on the community, I think that's an honest way to say it. And they say, well, that's kind of pejorative. And I say, well, if you're going to release a criminal in somebody's neighborhood, I don't care if it's pejorative or not. It should be. Most people, if you took a vote and said, how many of you want some convicted criminals released in your neighborhood? Now, we all know that most of these people will get out at some point. But if you say, what if we cut them loose early? Well, we're sending the criminal message that, by the way, we meant to lock you up for 10 years, but six is good enough. Go ahead. We know there's a 30% chance you're going to go back out and commit another crime, not reoffend, but commit another crime. Do you think there's any way we could get back to honest? Because I think if we dealt with this in honest language, it would be at least a start towards stopping this kind of stuff.
Well, I'm going to agree with you, Lars. I've always said that words matter and you need to use precise words precisely. And, you know, I think the other side, they're very artful in the way that they use their words. But talking about that 31% recidivism rate, you know, if we look at Governor Inslee's release of he released 1,016 persons early last year during the COVID. Those individuals, they have a 64% failure rate already after just a little over a year. 64% failure rate. And that's, you know, I'll give you an example of one guy, a 33-year-old man named Corey. And he was released early while serving a sentence for unlawful possession of a firearm. This guy had 7 prior felony convictions and 2 misdemeanors. He cut off his ankle monitor within 10 days of release and was arrested while high on meth and after attacking a 60-year-old woman in Everett. That's just one example, Lars. But, I mean, it certainly shows how getting people out of jail before their sentence is complete and their program of rehabilitation is complete, it puts the public at risk, and it actually sets that individual up for failure.
Yeah, and with that kind of rate, when we talk about the other rate, the one chance in three, and that's over a couple of years, we're not taking account of the fact that the folks you're releasing are not just average folks. These are the ones who didn't get their case dismissed, did get found guilty, did get sentenced, didn't beat it on a technicality of some kind. I think you're talking about a much more dangerous group of people anyway, aren't we?
Well, I concur. You know, and that goes to the idea of, you know, if there's a viable diversionary opportunity that can get someone on the right track and let them still provide restitution, then fine, let's embrace that. But for those people who are in our jails, they've been convicted, they've been sentenced, and, you know, there are repercussions for actions. And right now what we've got is we've got crime is at all-time highs. I outlined that last time. But we also have jail cell occupancy at historic lows. We're at 24-year lows for jail cell occupancy. And so the narrative goes, they're trying to eliminate 3,300 beds because they're only at 77% capacity because they want to save some money. But I'm saying that that's a bad idea, Lars, because we've been there and we've done that. And what happens whenever you reduce capacity is you cause overcrowding down the road. And then whenever we have overcrowding, as we did in 2018, they come up with these programs like graduated reentry to let people out of jail early because we have prison overcrowding. It's just this vicious circle that they're creating purposely or not. It exists.
Now, I'll tell you what, Senator Gildin, I've heard from conservatives who say it's expensive to lock people up. And I've told them, no, it's not. And I really think we need to change that narrative, too. And you say, well, the average inmate, not the high danger inmates, $25,000 a year. And they say, that's a lot of money. I said, yes, it is. It's $2,000 a month. It's $500 a week. You release the average felon to society and he's a meth head or he's a violent criminal. How much damage does that person do per week when he's out in society doing the things he was put in prison for doing? I'm willing to bet that it's way more than $500. The first person he hits in the head and sends to the emergency room is a lot more expensive than $500. I think locking somebody like that up for a period of time and trying to send a message is much less expensive than dealing with the human cost when people get beat to pieces or even murdered. That's Washington State Senator Chris Gildin. He represents Puyallup and that area as a state senator. We'll be back in a moment with your calls. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Let me go first to a naysayer. We've got a couple up, but so in this case, I have to choose between naysayers. Robert, you and I disagree about something. What is it? I have a feeling I think I know where you're going to go with this, but what's on your mind today?
Okay, let me shut off my truck and get off my radio.
Sure, I appreciate it.
Okay, yeah.
Nope. You got a dog, too. Oh, did the dog hang up the phone? Listen, folks, that wasn't me. We'll get Robert back on. It sounded like his dog might have jumped on the cell phone. So we'll get him back on. We'll give him his due time. Let's go to Eric instead. Eric, you're a naysayer. What do we disagree about today?
Hey, how you doing, Lars? I'm doing all right, man. Just a little curious on your COVID prevention. What were the origins of COVID again? I can't quite remember.
Let's see. The virus was developed in a lab run by the Chinese government and funded at least in some small part by the American taxpayers. Whether the virus was deliberately released by the Chinese, who had learned gain of function from Anthony Fauci funding gain of function research there or not, we don't know if they deliberately let it go or if it was just accidental because the lab was notoriously sloppy enough that 2 years before it was released, the U.S. State Department warned our government. Hold on. You asked the question. The U.S. State Department was warned this is a sloppy lab and you can't afford to be sloppy when you're dealing with bad viruses. So that was the origin.
Okay, so why was General Milley worried about us shooting a nuclear missile at China?
Because General Milley doesn't seem to be in his right mind. Because if he were, he would say, I may disagree with the president, but my job as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is to answer the commander-in-chief. If he actually thought the commander-in-chief had been incapacitated mentally, there's a process for dealing with that. He can go to Vice President Mike Pence back then in early January and say, I believe the president has lost his mind. Mike Pence could... You keep asking questions. I want to give you the answers. But what do you and I disagree about today? You keep asking me questions. I'm glad to answer them. But what do we disagree about?
You just stated... Okay, let me talk. You just stated that you think China created a biological weapon to attack America.
I didn't say that. I said I believe that China developed a virus. No, Eric, you don't get to put words in my mouth. Eric, you don't get to put words in my mouth. I said I believe China developed the virus. Whether it was a weapon or not is an open question. Whether they released it or not is an open question. What do we disagree about now?
Well, we disagree. One, I don't think that it was created intentionally. But I'm just trying to understand that if you actually think that China created a biological weapon to hurt us, and then you're
putting words in my mouth again, Eric. I don't like that. Eric, can I ask you a question or two since you've asked a bunch of me? Do you think that anybody in the U.S. military has the right to countermand an order given by the commander-in-chief?
Yes, absolutely.
How so?
Yes, if the commander-in-chief gives you an unlawful command...
No, hold on, but I didn't say unlawful. I said any order because, Eric, you're changing the subject because I'm well aware. Okay, Eric doesn't want to have a conversation. Eric,
that's an unlawful order.
How do you know? Eric, how do you know?
Hundreds of thousands of millions.
Eric doesn't really want to have. I'll tell you what, I'll finish for Eric. Eric wants to say that if Donald Trump ordered an attack on Russia or on China, it would automatically be an unlawful order. It would not. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is not aware of everything that the United States president is aware of. And the fact is, an attack on China did not exist in Donald Trump's mind. It did exist in General Milley's mind, which tells me General Milley may have been the one having mental problems because he was the one who imagined. I think Trump is crazy enough he'll attack China. Now, is there any evidence that Donald Trump was crazy enough to attack China? And the answer is no. So General Milley seized control of the nuclear weapons of the United States by telling the Pentagon, do not answer any order from the commander-in-chief before he knew what the order was. And on that note, I'm going to go back to Robert. Robert, did your dog hang up your cell phone?
Yes, he did.
Okay, my dog does crazy things, too. That's Sir Winston. What do we disagree about today, and does this have to do with one of your employees shooting one of your other employees?
Yes, it does.
Okay, let's go for that, because I want people to know we made so many phone calls on that today. This employee who shot or is alleged to have shot one of your other employees, you're convinced he actually did the deed, right?
Yes, he did.
Okay, fair enough. So So was he in police custody within the last couple of weeks?
That's what I just found out today, that he was, from the Salem police, as I was being interviewed by him just about an hour ago.
And here's what I'm curious about, because I had an email from a guy, and I didn't go into everything he said, but he said to me, hey, this is the state of where we are now. We've got a guy working for R&R, and this is nothing against your company. You hire guys and give them a chance to reform their behavior, their ex-felons or their ex-criminals, and you hire them. And I applaud that effort if they'll stay on the straight and narrow. What this emailer told me was, the employee who is now legally alleged to have, but you're convinced he did shoot one of his coworkers with a gun, had been in police custody within the last either a couple of weeks or a month, and he was arrested for being a felon in possession of a gun. Is that what you learned from the Salem police today?
Actually, it was on September 9th.
So only, he didn't make it a week. So, Robert, just so people, I don't think you disagree with me, and I don't think I disagree with you. What the emailer was saying was, you've got two guys, ex-felons, trying to reform themselves, working a real job.
One guy shot one guy.
Yeah, one guy shoots the other guy.
One guy was the ex-felon. The other guy wasn't.
Was not. Okay. So the ex-felon that you hired to give him a chance to straighten his life out, who gets caught a week, less than a week ago, with a gun and arrested, but not booked into jail because the jail said, we're not going to put him in jail. He was released, I'm guessing, on his own recognizance. Is that?
Yes.
And then he goes out and somehow secures another firearm. I assume they took the gun away from him. Is that right?
I have no clue.
but somehow
sure
he ended up with a gun and ends up getting in a dispute with one of your other employees who is not a criminal.
And that's what it's not about. That wasn't it. You know, the guy had been working for me for about 4 or 5 months. Yes, I knew he was a felon. I do give them chances because myself, I did 17 years on and off throughout my life, and I turned it around. Now I've owned this company for 23 years.
And God bless you for all of that.
They all were getting well, really fine. There was no fighting. There was no bickering. They were doing their job. There was four guys on the job site, and for some reason, they were pulling over a tree. And as my main guy was falling the tree, the tree hit the ground, and all they heard was bap, 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 and he took off.
You have no idea what inspired him to shoot somebody.
That's what we're trying to figure out now. Nobody knows. Even the cops don't know.
Yeah, and it's, Robert, I want to get your contact info off the air, but I'm glad we got that additional info because that's essentially what the emailer told me. A guy gets arrested by the cops for being a felon in possession of a gun and somehow has a gun less than a week later and shoots one of his coworkers. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to welcome back Mike Gonzalez, whose time is a bit tight today. Mike's a senior fellow of the Heritage Foundation, and he's the author of a brand new book called BLM, A New Marxist Revolution. And Mike, what I find interesting about this is that Amazon, that cut its teeth on selling books to Americans, is not letting you advertise for this new book about Black Lives Matter? Tell us the story, please.
So, Lars, I got breaking news. They did inform me. My book was published. That came out on the 7th, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. And Amazon informed us on Tuesday that they had stopped the ads because it had issues that were highly debatable, that people debate. So we protested, and today, a couple hours ago, Amazon contacted us and said they had reversed the decision, and they're running our ads. That they said this was a human error that they're trying to correct, but for a week. Our book has been out for a week. The fact that it had, quote-unquote, highly debated social topics, and they say that is not permitted, I don't know what else they're going to, you know, if we're not allowed to debate social topics, social issues, I don't see how democracy can subsist.
I don't either. I mean, Mike, if you said, I mean, with all nonfiction books, if you're not writing a book about something that people are debating, nobody's going to buy your book. I mean, how many books do you suppose I could find on Amazon among the nonfiction books where I say, ah, that's debatable or that's debatable? I mean, I'll bet Al Gore's books probably been books that have been written about climate change and all that. That stuff is all subject to debate. That sounds like a phony baloney answer to me.
Well, what the human error obviously was that somebody disagreed with my views and with what was there, so they decided to ban the ads. But I tell you, the book is selling super well, Lars. If you go there right now, on Amazon continues to sell the book. It's 314 in books, which is very well when you consider the millions of books that sell every day. And it's a bestseller in Black and African-American history, a bestseller number one in that category, number one in government social policy, and number two in political philosophy. So the book is selling exceedingly well despite Amazon's ban. I'm glad they reversed it, but what it means is that somebody there made a decision. And this is the problem with these tech giants. They're monopolies or near monopolies, and if they deplatform you, they can really take away your right of speech, you know. But I'm glad that they reversed the decision. In the end, they did the right thing.
Well, and Mike, and I know you got to go in a minute or so. I know you, Fox once talked to you, but the fact is, Mike, when companies do this, they know that you're not working for some fly by night. You're a senior fellow at Heritage. You know that if you don't dot all your I's and cross all your T's, that somebody's going to come after you and say, oh, Gonzalez said this and it was wrong, or he got a quote wrong. You know they're going to woodshed this book all day long and twice on Sunday, don't you?
Exactly. And by the way, what I do in my book is I give the founders and leaders of Black Lives Matter a platform. I quote them. I quote what they have said. I wrote this because the media would not do it. And I'll tell you one thing more than these attempts at censorship do, is that they produce a polarized society. Because as we can tell, conservatives are going to buy my book. But when they block the ads, they stop people in the middle or the center left from having a conversation with me, from being exposed to my ideas. So people, the result of big tech's censorship is make people more retrenched in their views, have a polarized society in which everybody decries, and yet this is the result, this is the outcome of big tech censorship.
It absolutely is. The book is called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Its author is Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation. And Mike had to go because he's got another commitment, and we totally understand that. This is a big deal. That big technology is trying to basically control the flow of information that goes to people like you and me, and that's just dead wrong. Let's go first to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I was just going to see if you had heard or read the story. I found it on Fox News, and when I was talking to your screener earlier, he was asking where
outline for my audience what you've seen, because the accusation is that that teachers are using highly sexualized, basically child pornography is what's being presented to kids in Hudson, Ohio, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, the video I saw, the mayor steps up and says, look, you got a choice. You either resign today or you go to jail. I've already talked to a judge, and she's with me on this. And that's kind of where the video cuts out at, you know. But that's not the only video I've seen. I've seen one the other day where a lady asked her son to bring home one of his books, and she's reading through this stuff, and it's very, very vulgar, you know, for a junior high school kid. You know, they were talking about somebody in fourth grade doing all these sexual things to, you know, two boys to each other. You know, they're reading this stuff to these kids in this class, and it's like, this stuff's not right.
No, it's not. And Bill, I'll give you an example, and I'll quote Daily Mail, which actually often does better coverage of what's going on in America than a lot of American of Daily Dead Fish Wrappers. They say that one of the lessons that was presented to these kids, you know, 16, 17-year-old kids, was write a sex scene that you would not show to your mom. This is the kind of stuff, and it makes me believe, Bill, that there are teachers out there. I was talking about one earlier that took down the American flag in her classroom because she said the flag represents menace and violence, and that it's terrifying to her to see an American flag. I can't believe any of these teachers are allowed to be in a classroom with young kids.
Exactly. Yeah, they should do some of these teachers what, you know, like when you become a police officer, you got to go through this extensive background and, you know, counseling and mental kind of, you know, testing and stuff. They should do a lot of this stuff for these teachers, you know, and require an extensive, you know, degree kind of stuff to where they, you know, they should just do a better job at, you know,
well,
select, meet up with select teachers who are actually going to, you know, better advance our children. You know, this is why we're so far behind in the world at, you know, in education and stuff. Is they've got stuff like this that are letting these teachers go around and teach these kids stuff that has nothing to do with learning anything. You know, those are life lessons that you need to learn as an adult. You don't teach these kids this kind of stuff.
Well, Bill, you know what drives me nuts is the teachers, and some of them are dead serious about it, and they're probably right. They say, we barely have enough time to cover the basics with these kids. Well, if you've barely got enough time to cover history and science and math and reading and geography and things like that, how do you have time for this kind of crap? Getting teenage
exactly.
kids to write sex scenes that are so raunchy that the teacher sets the bar by saying, write a sex scene that you wouldn't even show to your mother. How do you have time for that stuff when you say we barely have time to cover the basics?
And you're probably having them do it to satisfy their weird fantasies or something they've got. You know, I saw one, it was a teacher, she put on Twitter that she couldn't wait to get to class to check out her hot 18-year-olds or something, you know.
Oh,
she's at her sexual peak or something like that. And I was like, are you kidding me?
No, those people shouldn't be in the classroom at all. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And by the way, let me quote the teacher who wanted to take down the American flag. I've spent 23 years in the classroom, and you can't tell me what to do. I know my kids. I know what's best for them and what to do to make them feel comfortable. I took down the American flag because that's the most political symbol. She says that symbol does not stand for freedom or justice or equality. It stands for violence and menace and intolerance. And this woman has a job in an American high school classroom. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. That's right, it is. Glad to be with you on a Thursday. Don't forget, First Amendment Friday on this show for almost 25 years has celebrated your First Amendment freedoms. And every day of the week, we put naysayers to the head of the line. A couple of things I want to point out to you, and then I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Number one. Washington State, and I think Oregon by extension, stand to lose a huge percentage of state workers, thousands of them. And if you say, but Lars, you've always been arguing for a smaller government. Yes, but not when we lose the critical workers, the doctors, the nurses, the firefighters, the paramedics, the cops, the sheriff's deputies. Nearly eight, this is from the Seattle Times, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper of Seattle. Nearly 8% of Washington state workers are now seeking exemptions from Governor Inslee's vaccination mandate. Thus far, 5,000 state workers in 24 different agencies have sought exemption from being vaccinated for religious or medical reasons. Dozens of other state workers have filed a lawsuit against Governor Inslee over the mandates. We just heard, and we've been trying to get the Washington State Police Union to come on and confirm this. We've been told that everybody at WSP who has asked for a religious exemption has been denied. That's one technique that government is doing. The other one that's being done by private sector agencies, including hospitals and clinics, they tell a nurse or a doctor, yes, we'll grant your exemption, but we're not going to schedule you for any work, and we're not going to send you a paycheck, which is as good as firing them, except without actually firing them, because I don't think they want the optics of saying you fired hundreds of doctors and nurses in the middle of what you're telling us is a health emergency. Does that make any sense? It doesn't, so they don't want to do that. They say, we didn't fire them. We just told them we're not going to put them on the schedule, and they're not going to be working, and they're not going to be getting a paycheck, and that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The second issue, and I want to bring this up because we talk about judges and the effect that judges have. There is a judge who is retiring, and you might say, well, Lars, what's the big deal? Why is it a big deal that Judge Mike McClain is retiring? Let me tell you a short story, and I want to play a piece of audio for you. Former State Representative Mike McClain, who was the House Minority Leader, so he represented the Republicans in the House, he had stepped down from that leadership role. The House of Representatives wanted to gut a really tough law on violent crimes by juveniles. Not just a tough law. Measure 11 for juveniles was actually passed not once, but twice by the voters. While the state, you know, the state apparatus, the legislature and all, did not want to pass this law, but the people wanted the law. And the constitutions of both Oregon and Washington say that the people have the right to make laws. If they put it on the ballot and vote on it and get a majority, that they can pass a law. Measure 11 wasn't just passed by a majority. It was passed by more than 60% of the voters, which means it bypassed party lines. It was something the public wanted. And when the legislature told the public, hey, by the way, we think you should think about this again and vote on it again, the second time it got an even higher margin. Almost 75% of the voters, almost, said, we want this law. Well, then the legislature decided to gut it. Now, Mike McClain, as a state rep, had stepped down from his leadership role as minority leader, and officially he voted against it. But he, a lot of us believe, is the guy who helped torpedo that law. And he got some cover by saying, well, officially I voted against gutting it. But by that time, they already had the votes because he gave it really weak praise. It would be like if my workers came to me and said, hey, we'd like you to go and ask the boss, well, I am the boss, for a raise. I say, okay, I'll go in and say, hey, boss, the people I work with want a raise. But the boss knows I'm not really asking for the raise. I'm just wanting him to be the guy who officially says no. I believe that's what Mike McClain did. A short time after that, a conservative Republican, Mike McClain, state representative, was granted a state judgeship by far-left radical Democrat Kate Brown. And you'd say, well, why would Governor Kate Brown, a far-left Democrat who usually hands judge positions off to liberal Democrats and defense attorneys and the like, why would she do that? I actually asked Mike McClain that 2 years ago. Take a listen to his answer.
I don't think the governor gives a damn about qualifications, and I'd advance as evidence of that her pick for Albany for the judgeship. It was either Benton County, where she picked somebody who was thoroughly unqualified, wasn't even qualified to be a pro tem judge, and thankfully the voters threw her out in November. But she doesn't pick based on qualifications necessarily, and that's my evidence of it. So I don't think it matters about your qualifications. I'm not faulting that. I'm wondering why she decided to bestow this on you, and whether it has anything to do with the fact that she was able to get some, you know, you were a leader in the House. I know you stepped down from that leadership position, but you were a leader there, and somehow the Democrats managed to spit in the face of the voters, gut ballot measure 11 with the assistance of other Republicans. And I was hoping that leaders would go to these people and say, you cannot vote to gut this law. The voters voted for it twice. And I'm wondering if there was a prize in somewhere hidden in the box of Cracker Jacks.
Lars, I don't know how to deny it anymore. There absolutely wasn't.
Well, I got to tell you something. Mike McClain is now stepping down from the judge position he said he wanted. But let me point out something interesting. Mike McClain had been a state rep, which means he qualified for a PERS, a public pension. But the public pension would have been based on $30,000 a year. The fact that he was given for 2 years a judgeship means he was making $142,000 a year, and now his PERS pension will be based on that salary instead of the salary about one-fifth of that much. I think there's a clue there. And I think this is how Democrat governors do payoffs. You've got the Lars Larson Show.